Educators want to stay fresh with literacy instruction, but are so busy with students, they don't always have the time. All year long, Choice Literacy publishes and delivers the best K-12 literacy practices so that educators can grow their students as readers and writers with choice in literacy. Welcome to the Big Fresh Choice Literacy Podcast. I'm Ruth Ayers. Don't Plan a Lot by me, Ruth Ayers. Just don't plan a lot, Sam, one of my high school age sons, said when asked to share his hopes for summer break. If you don't make a plan for the things you hope to do, summer will slip through your fingers and it will be wasted, I said. He turned his clear blue eyes to me and said, if you plan too much, the goodness of summer is chewed up and creativity is destroyed. I've been thinking about his assertion for many weeks. Is it true that too many plans can ruin a good thing? Is it true that without plans, you waste a good thing? To both questions, the answer is absolutely. Soon, a group of contributors will gather for an in-person writing retreat. I've been working out the schedule, and Sam's words keep pricking me. I've committed to offering long blocks of uninterrupted time for contributors to write, or read, plan, walk, or chat. Whatever they need to generate creativity and courage to write is how they will spend the time. It is intended to be a gift. How often are we offered a long, uninterrupted block of time? Many educators excel in planning. We can make a school day run without a hitch. We can make a unit plan segue from teaching points to assessment. We can connect students to buses and run a pickup line with ease. Will we also allow ourselves some unplanned time? Whether it is a weekday evening, a weekend afternoon, or a summer morning, you can give yourself the gift of unscheduled time. This week, our newsletter is all about conventions. We're thinking about what does it take to make conventions stick? Jen Schwanke, our feature contributor and an elementary principal, joins me as we talk about the new features released on the site this week. Jen, you have a new article this week on the site called Editing to Consolidate. And I was reading through it, and in it, you know, you're talking about cutting these huge chunks of text. And I'm not sure that that's something you talk about in the article, how oftentimes as writing teachers, we're just so excited that kids are getting work down and words down that sometimes we're hesitant to talk about cutting it. And yet you make a really good case for putting kids in positions where they need to cut large amounts of their writing.
Right. I think it goes against the natural instincts of a writer to put a whole bunch of words on paper and then, you know, copy a chunk and delete it. It feels wasteful. It feels like you invested a lot and then by your own choice and will got rid of it. And so I think that goes against our natural nature. And especially when we're teaching students, you know, we say the hardest thing when teaching students to write is to just get ideas down, just start, just brainstorm. And then we tell them to cut it. And that seems very counterintuitive. But what I have found both as a writer and as a teacher is how much beauty there is in brevity and how proud students can be when they learn to say what they wanted to say and they really solidify their goals of communication by being concise. I think there's a lot of power in that. I know for myself as a writer, I thought, you know, I can say things well in fewer words. And so that's why I think it's important that as writing teachers that we make that an explicit instruction area.
I agree. When I was thinking about our conversation today, so you've written some books, I've written some books, and I'm curious, I have a file that's called Words I Can't Throw Away, but it's basically my throwaway file. So whenever I'm writing articles or books and I'm cutting things, but it feels like I'm cutting off my right, arm, right, I put them in this throwaway file. And I was looking for my book, Enticing Hard to Reach Writers. There were like 28,000 words in my throwaway file. And I was just thinking about how this is truly part of the writing process. And what you said, brevity is beautiful. Do you do this too as a writer? Do you have a throwaway file?
Well, it's so funny you said that because yes, I do. But I always put it in the file because I think I'm going to need it again. I think I'm going to go back and look at it. But to me, it's exactly the same as my closet. There are things that I'll put in the corner and I'll say, I'm not going to wear this, but I'm going to hang on to it for 6 months. And if I don't wear it in that 6 months, I'll throw it away. But you know what? I never wear it. And I never go back to my cut file because I think this speaks to why I believe big edits are so important. If it didn't need to be there, then it needs to be gone. And so sometimes I think, well, what if there's something really important here, you know, and it's the one line that's going to be an anchor of a new book. And what if I need it again? But the thing is, as human beings, we evolve and what we learn and what we know and what we want to say. And so I think for me, at least, I don't ever go back and read those things deeply because I've moved on from them. And I think when we put that kind of thinking onto a student who is so young, you know, they've maybe been on earth 9 years, 12 years, 16 years, 18 years, they're evolving at warp speed. And so we don't want them to think they have to hang on to anything that didn't work because they have the ability to recreate as they go along. And so that's not to diminish the files we have. I think those 28,000 word files are important because they honor the work and the energy and the effort that we put in the first place. But it shouldn't feel like a yoke on our shoulders that there's something we have to do with it.
Yeah, definitely not. And for me, it's freeing. I like in the article, you talk about how there's just that emotional swing of the heavy edit. And so I think when I have the ability to cut the words and drop them someplace else, then I don't feel like I'm throwing it away so much, but I am, because the truth is I rarely go back into there for anything because of the generative nature of writing. And I like to share that with kids, you know, like I have files full of thousands of words that I'm never going to use again, but I had to write them to get to the work that was going to go to public. And
right. And in this article, I wrote about a really fun activity I did with a class I was teaching, and I asked them to write a 5-page paper, but then I also asked them to write the exact paper in one page. So the 5-pager was for me, that was deep. It was all the specific details of the argument that they were making and so on. But the 1-page copy I wanted to share with other students kind of as a reference guide. And so that was really fun because what it did is accomplish what you and I are talking about here, going deep and saying all the things we want to say with all the words, but then also saying, okay, can I take out what amounts to 80% of that and still get my main point across? There's value in both. And it's about knowing what your audience needs, because again, that's why we write, so that someone will read it and get something out of it.
Definitely. And, you know, I think a while back, Jen, you wrote an article about parent communication. And it was an article where you were teaching teachers, because you're a principal, so you were teaching staff members how to make their writing more concise so that parents would read what we're sending home. Right. It reminded me of this a lot. Like, we just have to learn to cut so that our message can become more clear.
Especially for today's readers, Ruth, where, you know, they're used to the tweets or the Facebook posts or the text messages that really do have to be quite short. And so for people like myself and many students, we love words and we love to make sure that our points are made very, very thoroughly. But, you know, when we communicate with parents and with really anyone who's just going to skim our work, at first, we want to draw them in more so that they see that there's more depth there, but we just have to be careful with how many words we use.
Yeah, it's so true. Just the fast pace of the messages.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think your article really leads well into, we have another article on the site this week from Gretchen Schrader, and it's called, Is Grammar Check Cheating? Did you have a minute to read that?
I did, yes.
It's such a fast read, but so powerful. She starts off, you know, she's having this conversation and she refers to having her students put Grammarly on their computer, which is a grammar check program. And one of her friends is just indignant and is shocked that an English teacher would have her kids put a grammar check program on their computers. What were your thoughts about that?
Well, as I read it, I thought that this is the exact conversation that mathematics teachers have about calculators, and the exact conversation that we have with our children when they learn to drive, and we want them to simulate a driving process before they actually put a car on the road, right? I think it's just using tools that we have at our disposal. And the thing is this, my 14-year-old son, he and I talked about this because he wanted to use Grammarly. And the thing is, it's there and he's going to use it, whether I approve of it or not. And so what I tried to do is flip it so that I thought he will learn from seeing all of these examples done well, and he will learn from the suggestions. And so why not embrace that as a tool? One of the ways that I feel like I learned to be a strong writer is I had a class in college where we had to write responses, like annotated responses to the edits that the professor made. And that really helped me get in the head of the reader and why we would change some phrasings or move things around or put a comma here or a comma there. You have to get in the reader's world. And I think that studying suggestions that are made by something like Grammarly can get us there.
Definitely. And I think Gretchen does this. It's kind of a classic choice literacy article where she, you know, shares a problem and then she's just reflecting on it. And she asks herself, like, what is my purpose for using Grammarly? And she shares those reasons and just exactly what you're saying. And then at the end, I thought it was such a clever ending. She writes, if a tool like Grammarly can help students make their writing the best it can be, then I don't think it is cheating to use it. If I don't introduce my students to tools like this, am I not the one cheating them?
It's like, it's so true. Yes. Well, and they're going to find it, right? Because it's out there and it's an excellent resource. And so if she withholds it from them, to me, that's a little bit of a betrayal to students because you're not giving them all the supplemental resources that can help them be great writers. And being a writer, a lot of it is confidence and knowing that you can go out and find content or supportive resources to help you. I'm always big on analogies. I do it too much, but I specifically remember in seventh grade when the math teacher told me, do, you know, problems 1 through 51 odd, and the answers are in the back of the book. I thought it was crazy. I thought that's so stupid, right? But it's super fun because I'll get all the answers right. Well, it took me about 14 seconds to realize the value in that, because if I had the answer wrong, I had to go back and think about it. And that's what Grammarly does for writers. And if we want good content and we want them to believe in themselves as writers, Grammarly is a great tool.
Exactly. Well, Melanie Quinn does something similar in her article. It's called Conventions in Keeping It Real. And she's wanting to teach her elementary kids how to use quotation marks. And she's just trying to think about and come up with this really concrete hands-on way to teach some quotation marks. So what Melanie is having her students do is they're creating dialogue, and then Melanie is serving as a narrator and setting the scene. And then the kids are sharing the dialogue, and while they're sharing the dialogue, students are writing it on a whiteboard. And so what it's doing is creating this experience, a super concrete experience, where students are learning to write down the words that are coming out of a character's mouth. And that's what the quotation marks go around.
And one of the things I loved about Melanie's article, it was her care to not over-scaffold, which I think is important for quotation and punctuation marks, because you want to have a little bit of room for students to see where those things should go. And so doing it on the whiteboard, where errors can obviously be quickly handled and moved on, her determination to not over scaffold is going to be what gives them ownership, in addition to acting it out. And with Melanie serving as the narrator and setting the scene and the context, then she can hand it over to her students.
Yes. So one of my kind of go-to grammar instruction moves, instructional moves, is I love to know the history behind things. And right. Do you know this, that quotation marks actually used to be sets of lips? Did you know that to be true? And so there'd be a set of open lips where the person's mouth opened to begin saying the line of dialogue, and then the lips would close at the end of it.
Wow. And
if you go into like old Shakespeare texts, you'll actually see these lips that are open and closed. And over time, because you can imagine how tedious it would be to do that, they turned and became actually sets of quotation marks, which when kids learn that, it's just like poof, and they recognize, oh, it's an open mouth and a closed mouth, and it goes around just what's coming out of the person's mouth.
Well, and how ironic that you mentioned Shakespeare and that Melanie is using drama to teach punctuation marks, because that's exactly what, you know, describing what a quotation mark is. It's a visual depiction of someone saying something to an audience. And so the fact that it's the written word, as opposed to in Shakespearean days when they would have been acting it out, it's still a voice that's being heard by the reader or the person watching.
Exactly. And I think when kids know some of that background, or we use that background to tap into our instruction, it makes it authentic, and it gives a reason behind some of the conventions. Because so often it sometimes feels, you know, like just almost because of just to torture us, like, right. Why am I learning this? Or why can't I get the rule right? Which is how I opened my article, Three Expectations Regarding Grammar Instruction, which is in the Leaders Lounge part of our site.
Right. And those expectations, I love them, first of all, because there's only three and we can all handle three, but also because your reference to, you know, an open grammar book and 10 sentences to perform a rote task, those are the situations where students may say, okay, I need to see the value here. But your three expectations definitely help those students see value and see a reason to engage.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's so much that we're busy thinking about as school leaders, instructional coaches, literacy instruction. There's just so much that conventions, they matter, like standard English matters. And yet there can be so many strong opinions when it comes to grammar or conventions that in this article, I was just really trying to boil down three expectations that hold a lot of weight, but also are easy to remember and easy to put into practice. Not easy in like we have to think about it, but just it's a simple way to approach our grammar instruction.
Right. And, you know, if I can use that to segue into why choice literacy is such a strong resource for teachers, is every time I read an article, I think, oh my goodness, that's something that I can implement today. It's very practical. It's very applicable. And it makes my mind go into how that can actually look in the classroom. So for example, your three expectations for grammar instruction, you know, that's something that school leaders say, okay, this is how I can wrap my mind around what I want to be happening in language arts classrooms in my building. And then at the more granular level, there you have Melanie, where she can teach quotation marks through drama and through acting and through physical movement. And, you know, there's so many articles on the Choice site where if a teacher's just looking for that little piece of inspiration to, you know, the next day put something into action, that's the value of choice literacy. And that's why I love it so much.
Thanks, Jen. I think part of that is just a tribute to the contributors who are in the field, boots on the ground, and they're reflecting on their practice. And it's so authentic and really, it's easy to use, like you said, just the next day. And like, we don't have to do a whole lot more research, right? Like, you read the article. And also, I think there's that the just the core belief of choice literacy, adding giving students choice and voice in their reading and writing, holds true throughout the articles on the site.
And the other thing is they're so manageable. You know, you get your newsletter and you can skim through it and find out what speaks to you. And it's not a commitment of an entire text where you might read the whole book and only have a few things that you can actually implement. But the brevity of the newsletter is just so valuable for busy teachers who are making, you know, hundreds and hundreds of decisions a day.
Yeah. Before, you know, before I was, behind the scenes at Choice Literacy, but as an instructional coach, and even before that, as a classroom teacher, I always like the Big Fresh would show up in my inbox and I'd think, oh, I'm so busy, right? And then I was like, Ruth, 15 minutes, just 15 minutes, and you're going to have a pulse on what's happening in literacy instruction. And I think that still holds true today, that just 10 or 15 minutes and you kind of, you have a good idea of what's happening today.
You know what? Exactly. I've been thinking a lot and doing some work on the side about evolution of instruction. And, you know, there's just some things that we as teachers need to abandon. And I've joked with my staff before, if it's still a purple mimeograph that you're running through the copier to make the print black, it's time to evolve and move on. And I tell you that because choice literacy to me leads that evolution. Mm-hmm. So you said, you know, you're up to date or with what's going on in literacy instruction. This is all very, very modern, contemporary thinking about literacy instruction. And I think as teachers, we have that responsibility to stay sharp and stay fresh and see what the new stuff and the new thinking is.
Mm-hmm. And without doing a big Google search or getting lost, you know, on social media, just each week it comes in your inbox. So there's this article that I was so excited. I was excited that he wrote it, and I'm excited that it's being published this week. But there's a contributor, Matt Renwick, and he's a friend of ours. He's a principal in Wisconsin, and he wrote an article called Resisting the Scripted Curriculum. Did you get a chance to read that?
I did. Matt.
I can't wait to hear your thoughts.
What I love about Matt's article is something that I have long bothered me about districts who purchase a commercial program, right, from a vendor, and then they expect teachers to use it without deviating from what the publisher wanted. Now, let's keep in mind, publishers want to make money, right? That's why they're there, and that's fair. There's nothing wrong with it. But as such, publishers, and Matt says in there, publishers sometimes use the term fidelity to the program to reinforce that administrators really need to stay on top of this, right? And make sure those teachers are doing this right. But you have to just keep in mind that the publisher, it behooves them to insist that there be fidelity to the program. What that does is take out differentiation. It takes out the particular student population that's sitting in the room. And it takes out fabulous supplemental resources that a teacher who, by the way, is probably highly educated and knows exactly what resources they should use. It takes out the freedom to supplement instruction with other good materials. So I have long had a real issue with vendor-based programs or scripted instructional practices. I just don't think it honors the intelligence and education that teachers bring to the classroom.
Yeah, I highlighted that same line that Matt wrote about fidelity to the program. And it made me wonder, like, well, what are we having fidelity to? And in Matt's article, you know, it's making this case to the choice and voice of the readers and writers inside the classroom. And he writes, just following that, this is a recipe for inequity. Following right. A program instead of responding to our students' needs. But then what Matt does in the back half of the article is he has this segue, teachers may not be able to refuse the use of a commercial program. And he teaches very succinctly four ways to look at that scripted program and make sure that you are responding to the students in front of you.
Right. And if it's okay, Ruth, I think we should highlight those four things here for listeners to maybe dig in. Matt says, you know, let's maximize any part of the resource that engages students in actual text, which is, if you do that alone, you're winning. Mm-hmm. He then says, though, conversely, minimize and eliminate any tasks that don't engage them in text. He suggests that we conduct research around parts of the resource to assess its effectiveness. And, you know, that auditing piece is huge to see if it's even working with our students. And then he says, you know, this is like a permission slip to me. He says, improve some of the tasks in the resource, make them better. And this is where that the teacher's instinct and knowledge in education and differentiation can come into play.
Yes. I love, you know, that number two where you said minimize or eliminate any tasks that do not engage students in actual text. And he tells us to ask ourselves, is this what real readers and writers do in their daily practice? Exactly. I just think it's so wise. You know, like there's little activities that we can maybe make a case for, but just that idea of like, is this how they live in their whole sense of reading and writing?
Well, and I think it's important to make a distinction, I guess, on Matt's behalf here. This isn't defiance or this isn't insubordination to the publisher. What this is wisdom that you, as the teacher, will acknowledge that, you know, if there's not the right background knowledge or interest in the task, if there's not any value in it for their daily practice, then there's no need to do it. It's just going to waste their time. And so, again, it's not defiance, it's wisdom.
No. And, you know, if Matt were joining the conversation, I know that he would affirm that because he does, you know, he's the leader of the school and there are common practices that you know, he expects from teachers. At the ending of his article, you know, he talks about how all the suggestions have the common intent for students reading, writing, thinking about, and talking about authentic text and really driving home that point of meaningful literacy tasks. And they're difficult, right? Like they're difficult to find in textbooks, but that doesn't mean that we have to completely go rogue from a resource that we're asked to use in our classrooms, because I'm sure we can agree, you know, if those are the rules we're asked to play by, then it's important that we do honor what we're asked to do.
Exactly. What I love here is in his article, Matt discusses, and I'm sure it's not their real names, he talks about Brooklyn and Maddie. You know, these are two students, they're real life people who have their own specific interests. And Matt says, what's meaningful to one might not be meaningful to the other. And that's what's restrictive about commercial textbooks or programs. But that's where the real life teacher comes in and makes the decisions that will help the learning be challenging and rewarding to all students.
So we have this collection this week of articles. This is about conventions. And the question that, you know, is posed this week is, how do you make conventions stick? And it actually came from a conversation Gretchen Trader and I were having. And she's like, you know, even after 20 years in the classroom, I'm still asking myself, how do I make conventions stick? What are some of your thoughts around that?
It's a question I think haunts language arts and English teachers. We want them to stick. When we let go of our students at the end of a year or at the end of you know, several classes that we've had with them, we want those conventions to stay stuck, right? But so I think that we as teachers, and I don't just mean literacy teachers, by the way, I think all teachers need to buy into the importance of conventions. But there is a little bit of wiggle room there for students to get it wrong or for students to create their own style and voice. There are books out there by fabulous authors who have done a wonderful job being able to take their own voice and maybe manipulate conventions a little bit to make it work. But you know what? Those authors knew the basic conventions first before they started playing with it. And so I know I'm getting into a whole different topic and article and probably a newsletter for Choice Literacy in the future. But I think writing teachers, reading teachers, math teachers, social studies teachers, we all need to understand the value of conventions, because ultimately that's how our writers will be judged in their writing and their communication using the written word. And so there's huge value in remaining committed to getting that right.
Yeah, and that, like, just to what I was thinking about, you know, the final thoughts about how do you make conventions stick, I wholeheartedly agree. Like, kids need to know this is how this is how it works in a standard way. And for me, the thing that I've always tried to keep in mind that has impacted my grammar instruction more than anything is that idea of understanding errors are a sign of growth. So I think oftentimes we want everything to be perfect, and it's simply not going to be that way. You know, each week the Big Fresh is copy edited and it comes back, and each week I have standard English mistakes, conventional mistakes that someone else has caught for me, and I'm correcting it. And I just think like that is just truth of being a writer. As we're growing, we have errors in our writing until we really learn how to control some more sophisticated moves when it comes to conventions.
I'd like to take this back to the articles in this week's Choice Literacy newsletter, because I think the voice of all of the contributors is very clear. We're not looking for perfection. We're looking for growth, and we're looking for students to be able to communicate effectively. And so perfect writing never happens, to your point. You know, here you are sending this newsletter off, and it always comes back with a few things that would be better said differently. And so, you know, they say writing is never complete. It's always a draft. And I think that's really true. And it's something that we can make sure our students understand too.
At Choice Literacy, we know that you want to be an educator who makes students' lives better through literacy. In order to do that, you need access to comprehensive literacy practices delivered in a way you will actually use. With over 150 in-the-field contributors, we understand the pressure to reach a variety of needs and not enough time to do it, which is why we hold true to workshop tenets like choice and share practical ways to plan and deliver literacy instruction straight to the point of student need. You can find links to all of the articles discussed in the show notes, or sign up for the Big Fresh so you can have the links delivered directly to your inbox. Keep growing readers and writers by offering choice in literacy.